Lessons from Flight 1549, the testimony of the cabin crew. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Today, part four of our presentation of the testimony of the various players in the Miracle on the Hudson, recorded last month before the U.S. House Aviation Subcommittee. Mention has been made of the role the cabin crew played in a successful outcome following the ditching of U.S. Airways Flight 1549. But you may be surprised to hear how little the flight attendants really knew about what was happening from their vantage points in the cabin, especially after interphone function was lost. You're about to hear from Sheila Dale, Doreen Welch, and Donna Dent, who brought a total of 93 years of experience to work with them on that day.
For the flight attendants, we heard what took place from the air traffic control tower, and we've heard what took place from the cockpit. I wonder if you might tell us, as soon as you discovered that there was a problem, what you did and walk us through it. Ms. Welch, would you like to go?
Like I've said before, we heard a thump, which was the birds, which we didn't know at that time, and it was kind of like hitting something in the air. And then in the back where I was, the smell was pretty strong. And I thought, for some reason, there might have been an electrical fire. That was just my guess at the moment. So I got up and I looked for Sheila. I saw Sheila up front, but our interphones didn't work. So really, in that time span, I thought, well, we probably lost an engine, and we were going to go back and land at LaGuardia, and it would be that. So I got back in my seat, and not long after that, I heard brace for impact. Words you don't want to hear as a flight attendant, but I didn't know. I think Jeff said it was 3 minutes. I've always wanted to know from start to finish. It was because at some moments it seemed long, and at some moments it seemed like a snap, but it seemed... After the brace for impact, it seemed quick to me that we did hit, which I assumed we were on the ground for some reason. I thought we attempted to go back to LaGuardia. I mean, I just thought this in my head. I don't know why. And we were on the runway and didn't make it. And so after getting out of my seat and going to the, because my doors are behind me, after going to the door and looking out and seeing water, whoa, like I said, it was the biggest shock ever. So... I gave it one second thought, can I get one, because we landed in the back, but we still weren't down like we saw the plane. I thought, do I have 1 second to get a raft out of here? And that water was rising. I thought, no. And as I turned around, passenger shoved by me and just started grabbing everything on the door and cracked the door. So it was when the water started coming in rapidly. And I went back to try to close it, and then it was coming in just... I don't know the time, but it was just rising like crazy. I went back again with both hands and tried to close it, but it just wasn't going to happen. And turned around and saw there were so many people. I assumed for some reason, like I said before, that the whole plane was even. So I thought we were all going to be under that water. It's just how I thought. And then at the last minute, I just got this burst and started, people were in shock like I was or had accepted that this was pretty much it because the water was just about there. And I just went crazy and started ordering people to go to the wings and having them climb. We never would have all made it down that aisle. So I started having people, those were able to climb over the seats. I said, just make your goal, get to the wings. It's our only hope, get to the wings. We have seconds. So... The few people that were in front of me, looking back, they had to be in shock. Like, I was for a second there with that water, and then I screamed and snapped them out of it and got up to the wings. And like I said before, I thought, might make it. So after everybody there, it might have been one or two people that followed me. I saw Sheila and went up to the 1R door and went out on the raft. And that's when I realized I was injured because I didn't know until then.
And can describe for the members of the committee your injury, what happened to you.
Well, I don't know, but I mean, I didn't realize until I got to the front door that I felt the pain and everything. I obviously walked into something, or I had heard that something had come up from the floor, but my guess is that I did it after under that ice water because I wouldn't have felt it. So I have no idea what, I couldn't even begin to guess what I did it on. It's like an angle iron, it's like an L shape, so I can't even imagine.
If I can ask the same question of you, Ms. Dale.
Well,
When we were sitting in our jump seats and heard the thump, Donna and I had just a moment to whisper. I whispered to her, "What was that?" And she said, "I think it was a bird strike." I'd never experienced such a bird strike, so. But the few moments between then, it was eerily quiet. I smelled the smell. There was a little bit of smoke when I looked down the aisleway. But actually, we just sat there waiting. We knew the guys were busy up front. At some point, they would tell us what to do. And when we heard the command, brace for impact, our training just kicked in, and we began our commands. And then when we hit the water, we just followed through with what we yearly. We have a yearly recurrent training. And I was due for mine the following week and had my workbook filled out. So I had looked over the information, and Donna had recurrent in the next week after me. But the training, I will have to say, the recurrent training that I've gone through for 28 years prepared me to do what I did.
Ms. Dent?
We did have a very different experience up front. It was much calmer, I think, and very civilized. When we realized that, when we heard the brace for impact, as Sheila said, we began our commands. And when we heard the evacuation command, we started yelling our evacuation commands. But at that point, we didn't know we were in water. So when I assessed, I looked out my window and saw that there was movement. I thought we were still on land, and I thought we were moving. So I yelled for Sheila to wait, not to open her door yet. And then I yelled, "We're in water," and opened my door, inflated my slide, and just started evacuating passengers.
We'll be back in a moment with some final observations from the crew of Flight 1549. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from AeroNews.
Remember what the future used to look like? The flying cars, the spaceports, the rocket packs and spandex outfits? That was some future, wasn't it? But hey, here's the real future. A Garmin Wass Navigator. It makes its own glide path out of GPS signals, so you can land IFR at thousands of airports with no ILS or other ground-based approach aids. Now that's a future you can believe in. Garmin Wass GPS. Follow the leader.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and known ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. Clarity Aloft headsets are known for the superior clarity of sound. They're lightweight but rugged enough to meet military specifications. Best of all, they boast better noise reduction than ANR in the speech frequencies that matter most to you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to Lessons from Flight 1549. We wrap up today with final questions about birds, local airports, and proficiency concerns for pilots going forward.
Chair, thanks to the gentleman, and now recognizes the gentleman from Tennessee, the farmer Chairman of this subcommittee, Mr. Duncan.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for calling this hearing. And, you know, we've been given these statistics about 7,500 bird strikes reported in 2007 and the numbers since 1990. Is this a growing problem in your minds, or has this been going on pretty much at the level it's at now? And are there any airports where it's worse than others?
Well, one of the reasons that you're seeing that there appears to be a growing problem is the reporting requirements for bird strikes have increased dramatically just in recent years. Last week, though, I did actually tour my local airport, and the airport manager took me around, and I had no idea what they actually have to go through to combat birds and bird strikes on their airport. I'm no expert on it. You're certainly going to have experts who are going to testify. But in many ways, the airports are somewhat hamstrung by a lot of regulations that, you know, environmental regulations, for instance, that protect them or prevent them from handling these specific instances. For instance, the airport manager where I live, they extended a runway. Where they extended it happened to be into a little bit of a marshy area, and they were required by federal regulations to actually recreate another wetland right next to one of the runways because they had to recreate it on their property. And, of course, wetlands actually attract birds. And it's a much more difficult problem, too, because every bird species seems to have their own things that they don't like. For instance, some don't like sound. But, for instance, seagulls, they don't care about sound. The little propane cannons that they use at airports don't affect them at all. But what apparently affects seagulls mostly is if you shoot one of them, because if they see a dead seagull, they disappear. And in some areas of the country, for instance, I believe California was what the airport manager mentioned where I live, it's actually illegal to shoot any kind of bird. They have to either trap them and take them someplace else or use some other sort of mitigation techniques. So I'm sure you're going to get testimony on that, but perhaps some of the rules do need to be refined around airports to give them more latitude.
Do most of you feel that most of the airports in the country are doing everything they can to combat this, or do you think this is something that they need to do a lot more about?
I think one thing is that most airports in this country are locally controlled and operated. There are, of course, federal standards, but it's really up to each individual airport operator to determine whether or not and to what extent and how they will control the birds that happen to be in that particular area.
Chair, thanks the gentleman, and now recognizes the gentleman from Ohio, Mr. Boccieri.
Is it appropriate to require more training with simulation I remember going through our simulator flights and experiencing every aircraft mechanical emergency that you could ever experience? Is the training adequate from your perspective as a flight check pilot to what we give to those who with lower number of hours?
It's important as one generation gives up the profession and hands it over to the next that the body of knowledge of what we do and why we do it continues. There must be a continuity. You have to know the history. You have to know about the seminal accidents that Chairman Obistar talked about and others that are really the reasons for much of what we do. You have to know not just what to do, but why we do it, so that when you're in a very critical, time-critical situation, and there isn't time to use every checklist or consult every reference, that you know what clearly you must do. You have a very clear idea about what your priorities are, and in the limited time you have available to you, what steps you must take.
That concludes this installment of Lessons from Flight 1549. Time will tell whether the lessons which can be gleaned from this famous ditching will remain with members of the U.S. House Aviation Subcommittee, and how the threat of bird strikes is weighed against other interests who come to Washington to root for the geese. Immediately after the close of this hearing, there was a second one, at which lawmakers heard comments from experts on a variety of topics related to the Miracle on the Hudson. We'll bring you edited comments from that hearing in future AeroCasts. You've been listening to a special feature from AeroNews. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend and have a clear and unlimited day.